quite heavily in our structure for the Department of Magic. We were trying to create a large open space. Stuart wanted to create a large glass dome, which sort of the interior would reflect as if you're inside a glass jewel. So the faceted glass panels would reflect the light from the magical space outside. So we wanted to create this large open dome atrium with all the working space below and the offices above. So the main layout for this Department of Magic is a series of interlinking domes. So you have a main dome in the centre, which is the main atrium dome where we see them first enter. And then rather than being a series of stories, we move through domes. We were able to build over a half of the actual set. So you could always play one side for the other, or flip it round, or turn left, or turn right, and still believe that you're moving to another place, rather than being confined into one circular dome. With it being circular, it was quite convenient that we could then allow it to be shot in either direction, because you can turn left out of a dome or turn right out of a dome and still go into another interlinking atrium.
Working from Stuart's initial designs, Sam and the team first produce a series of concept drawings and illustrations before creating a digital 3D model of the set. This allows Stuart and the director, David Yates, to walk around the set virtually and make changes to its design. And once the design has been finalized, the art department then produce architectural drawings and blueprints. Dory Young is a senior draftsman on Fantastic Beasts: The Crimes of Grindelwald.
I drew quite a lot of the buildings for Paris, which was really exciting for me because it's the first time I've been senior enough to be given ownership of something in its entirety just for me. On previous jobs, I've been too junior and I've mainly been in charge of drawing doors and windows. Stuart, in particular, is very keen to have everything we do based in some kind of reality. Even though we're creating a magical world, he doesn't like the idea of just being able to solve problems by saying, oh, well, it just stands up by magic, or it's a completely invented thing, because then it just makes the whole world feel false and not doesn't quite work. So we always start with some solid reference and then extrapolate from that.
As well as architectural drawings, designs, and 3D models, every set is also built as a practical model using white cardboard. These are displayed in a room at one end of the art department. Its walls covered in images and mood boards so that everyone can see the layout of each set.
So here we are in the model room. We sometimes call it the war room for reasons unknown. It contains all of the concept art and the models for each set, so it gives quite a good overview of the visual style of the film. I don't do the concept art myself, but I am involved in making the models. It's part of the design process. So once the plans and elevations of a set are drawn up, then we quite often make a cardboard model from those plans and elevations. And the purpose of those models is to make sure that what we're going to build is what the designer wants to see and what the director is expecting. The scale is 3/8 of an inch to the foot. It's big enough that you can see all of the details that you're expecting and get a good idea of it, but it's not so big that it takes over the whole damn room.
Transforming the art department's blueprints and models into the full-size sets is the job of the film's construction manager, Paul Hayes. Paul works closely with Stuart Craig on every detail, and trust me, there's a lot to consider.
Stuart is a genius, without a doubt. His vision is second to none. So he'll sit down and he'll just do a little sketch, sometimes a pencil sketch that he'll hand to me, and then we'll work out what the finishes are and we'll work our way back from that. I will then go off, instruct all the HODs of the various departments to do a sample board. It might be texture, paint, it could be, sometimes we're using concretes as well, and we'll work our way through so we get a big menu for each of the sets all laid out for us, and then Stuart will then work his way through that, choosing each of the different textures and paints as we go through all of the sets. On average, we normally have about 110 sets to build. That can increase to about 130 to 140 sets.
And every one of them has been meticulously designed down to the smallest nook and cranny.
For me, if you look at every inch of it, it's all been considered, it's all been designed. You know, there's not a detail left off. You just, for Stuart to think of every bit like that and consider it, that's a lot. I think this is the beauty of this industry. You don't realize the effort that goes into everybody's department.
That includes the actual construction. Oh, it's going to get a little bit noisy here.
Chris Peters is one of the British film industry's unsung heroes, a behind-the-scenes magician. You guys are doing great. As head of metalwork, Chris's role is to take the set designs supplied by the art department and break them down into workable sections. Oh, that's hot, man.
As a set is built on the Leavesden lot, the air becomes loud with the sound of blowtorches and metal saws as Chris, with his team, construct the scaffolding, crossbeams, rivets, and struts that are used to support the structure of the more elaborate sets.
My trade's an architectural metal worker, and I got into it when I was 17 from school and on an apprenticeship for 5 years. This industry I got into via people in the game that have worked with me outside in the architectural metalwork world. It's good fun. Flown by. Absolutely flown by. Every day you come in and you think, well, what are we going to do today? Oh, yeah, we're doing this. It's good fun. Okay. Before you know it, the day's gone. It's frightening, really, when you think about it. Do you know?
The French ministry set was a challenge. In the film, French wizards and witches take a birdcage elevator down into the ministry's main atrium. The atrium features a celestial glass-domed ceiling with magical constellations shaped as the various beasts. Towering wooden doors are adorned with Art Nouveau-style carvings, which resemble trees. And to create all of that in real life takes more than a little magic.
There's going to be some big numbers here, folks, so listen up. The center of the main dome reaches a height of 52 feet, enough room to stack 3.5 double-decker buses. I don't want to be in that half a bus. The set floor is an intricate puzzle of over 340,000 square feet of tiles, all hand-finished, with 6 coats of paint and lacquer. Over 16,500 rivet heads were applied to the steelwork. I counted every single rivet head myself in between takes. And over 7 tons of bespoke steel structure make up the convex mezzanine floor. I mean, someone should just give me an award for saying convex mezzanine floor.
Whew. All that steelwork. You probably don't even know there's steelwork in there. I don't know, is that a good thing not to see all the steelwork and realise? Because it's all part of the magic, isn't it?
Even though the sets appear magical, they must serve a very practical purpose, namely being safe for the cast and crew to work on.
Everything they walk on, all that circular section, we got all that done. All the curved windows, it's all steelwork in that that holds all that up. That's radius, all the T, all the handrail that goes around it. All the beams underneath, it's all steelwork. A lot of it's hidden in the set, but it has to be there. It's a structural component of the set. If it's not there, it's going to fall down. Where people are going to be walking, actors, crew will be walking on, we need to make it structurally sound. You'll see a staircase and automatically your mind will think, oh, I can walk on that. Well, it's not always the case in this game, but we need to make it safe. Like where areas where we know that people are going to be walking, we need to make that safe, and we do that with steelwork.
But it's not all welding and hammering, rivets and cross beams. Listen to me getting all technical.
You've got to be pretty good with your mathematics as well, with the trigonometry. Working out what the overall length of the arcs will be and what your radiuses will be. And it's got to be right. You've got to be spot on because everything else is going to go around it. You don't see it, but it's in there. And if it isn't right, that's stage one. So it has to be right. And that's what we do. We're a team. You know, we're not an individual. We're all a team. And that's how everyone sees it. Because you're not sort of like having one idea. You're having all the experience of the whole crew. That puts an idea into it. How are we going to figure this out? How are we going to solve it? You've got years and years of experience there, so use it.
Which certainly came in handy when building Le Ministère des Affaires Magiques. As art director Sam Leake explains. Wait a minute, that rhymed.
We really built to the limits of the stage. We were filling every square inch of the stage that we had to achieve the biggest set we could get away with, to keep the actual vastness and openness of this glass dome as manageable as we could get. Because of that, we were able to build nearly two-thirds of the full circle, although structurally it proves more of a problem because you're breaking the circle, so the steelwork became more technically challenging to keep the floor raised above everybody's heads.
Once the steelwork's in place, the set is built on top by teams of carpenters and craftsmen using wood and plaster. Then, it's painted. Once that's complete, the set must be dressed. A term you heard back in Chapter 1, there's going to be a quiz. Set dressing is a process of layering, adding everything from carpets to croissants, books to wallpaper, furniture to cobwebs to help bring a set to life. But given the nature of the film and the 1920s period setting, finding the right materials and objects isn't always easy. Vintage items have to be sourced, while everything else is created from scratch. One set that required a lot of dressing was Diagon Alley's French counterpart, Place Cachée, which means hidden square. Inspired by a real Parisian square that J.K. Rowling discovered during a research trip, Place Cachée is a beautiful little spot that appears quite normal. That is, until Newt and Jacob head through the skirt of a statue. Suddenly, they're transported into Paris's magical shopping district, a place packed full of wizarding shops as well as Circus Arcanus. This set required a whole host of graphic design elements created by Mirafora Mina and Eduardo Lima, collectively known as Mina Lima. We find them tucked away in Stuart Craig's art department in a room covered from floor to ceiling in vibrant images, fonts, posters, and artworks that deliver constant inspiration. For Mirafora Mina and Eduardo Lima, Paris in the 1920s was a blast.
Fantastic period to be thrown into as a graphic designer, a bit of a gift really, 1927 in Paris. For us, the gamut of what we have to cover is so vast, from perhaps a tiny ticket to signage on the side of a building or wallpaper designs, that everything will start with research. And that, in this case, could be to reflect those requirements. We went to Paris and we bought a lot of ephemera from the flea markets. We went to the archives to look at old typography and patterns and wallpaper designs, really accumulating as much visual material as possible to inform how we might then turn that into a kind of our wizarding interpretation. And we do buy a lot of books as well. So all of that material kind of ends up back in our base here at Leavesden. We kind of cover our walls so that we're completely immersed in everything to do with the period. So amongst that reference material, things like poster designs, you know, you realise as you're going a bit deeper how things were crafted in the period. So everything would have been hand-painted, which presents its own challenges to us, because we have to, obviously, we're going to achieve that kind of aesthetic. We're going to have to use the same processes where possible. So there was quite a lot of hand-drawing and artworking in our interpretations of the reference material that we found.
One of Mina Lima's noteworthy designs was the Daily Prophet from the Harry Potter films. They also designed the New York Ghost in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And now, extra, extra, read all about it. They've added to their newspaper empire with a French title, Le Cri de la Gargouille. To fill these magical newspapers, Mina Lima often sneak themselves into the pages from time to time.
On Harry Potter, I was Shameless, the chief editor of the Daily Prophet. And when we had Fantastic Beasts and we had to do the New York Ghost and the Daily Prophet from that time. And now we have the French version as well. So we are the collection of the global newspaper. Yes.
What was really nice on this as well was that we did have an opportunity to suggest titles for this particular newspaper. We referenced some specific bits of architecture in Paris at the Notre Dame that also felt like appropriate to a wizarding world. Yeah, Le Cri de la Gargoyle, which is like the screams of the gargoyle. It gave us an opportunity to just kind of anchor it in that world, because they, whenever you see those gargoyles on Notre Dame, which is so central to Paris, they always feel like there's a whole other kind of world going on up there. Yeah. So that seemed like a good way in.
But again, it's the same kind of style that we established the Daily Prophet. The same convention that we adopt for the Daily Prophet, we still use on the New York Ghost and the French one. It's a mixture of serious headlines, what is happening at the moment, and also loads of funny and no headlines about how the wizard lives are funny. And that is the thing that we learned from the Daily Prophets, that the fans really enjoy to, they have the headline, the first one, but they like to go around and check every single little thing that we added there as well. And again, we always say that the newspapers, we could have gone really wild and done like a different format, but the newspapers look like a newspaper. It's just when you get close that is, okay, it's a wizard one.
That's just a little part of the whole wizarding world being made to feel real for the viewers. And it happens everywhere in the architecture, the costumes, the props. Everything has this kind of, is underpinned with a real situation. So everything you see around us in terms of designs is, will be, we will have looked at how that would have been. That way the viewers can know it, they can feel it, and they can be there and say, I've had that news, I think I've read that news before, I think I'm going to get that letter. Or so it's not too far removed from what we're familiar with.
The main headline comes from the script and from David, and sometimes even the ones that come from David, when he sees printed, and the main headline is sometimes is a battle, you know, until you get the right one. But all the other ones is where we have fun as well, and where we can ask the guys in our department as well to come up with ideas, and everyone kind of bring lots of,
We'll try and make them topical to the place and the time.
This one we will play with the Mona Lisa, saying that she is like a, she's a portrait, a moving portrait, and so she decides to go off and she doesn't come back, so people are waiting for her. Things like that, that we try to be part of the city, and
Boy, I sure hope that Mona Lisa shows up. Once the graphics have been conjured up by Mina Lima, they're often sent over to Julian Walker, who's the head decor and lettering artist.
The streets is a big one for my department because it is basically every kind of surface or shop front, you know, we've had to do something on it. The Parisian kind of winding streets, that whole section with the stairs, the steps leading down. And then also the circus as well, because we're on to getting stuff done for the circus now. There's three quite large show banners that I've got to paint. Those three have got to be painted, but they've got to be done in the real, the old kind of freak show, slightly naive kind of painting. They're not like amazingly painted, because it would have been people, you know, back in the day who were saying, oh, can, you know, we need this done. But he's the artist, so he can do it. And they're kind of a bit crude, but full of character.
Using traditional tools, a rather large stick to steady his hand and a paintbrush to be precise, he paints the tiniest details directly onto the sets.
The main core would be sign writing, like traditional hand-painted lettering. We veer into stencil work. Obviously, we have a bit of technology where we can generate graphics identically from files from the graphics department. But ultimately, they still want the hand, a hand-done feel, which we now can do in various forms, so it doesn't look as if everything we've done has been printed. So we generally just using quite old skills, but in a modern kind of form, really.
For Julian, the move from New York to Paris meant not only a change in scenery, but a change in style.
The Parisian streets are much narrower, much smaller. There's a lot more going on in the terms. It's not so kind of gridded. Like, I guess in New York, obviously you've got your blocks, so it's like a block layout. And obviously in the first film, you had the very grand buildings. And even when we got up to the kind of Brooklyn end, the slightly more run-down end, that's where we ended up with a ton of hanging signs. This one, the Parisian streets are slightly more refined, I think, with the way that it's presented. It's, I don't know, a bit slicker. It's a real flow to it. It's really nice stuff to do. And when we first sort of knew it was going to be Parisian streets, it was like, oh, that's good. And we knew you're going to get into real lovely designs. But also, as well, we're now getting the switch around from Muggle world to the wizard world. So some of the streets, some of the shops we've already done, some of the windows or the graphics, they will be taken down. And now we do the wizard look, which is obviously much more intricate and pretty unique, because it's just this wizard world, so they can do what they want, really. But it does take a while to switch into it, especially if you've come off something, say, like you might have done a sci-fi before, or a modern-day thing, and then you slip into a period Parisian street, you do need to soak it in. I mean, we just try and, like, fill, you know, the walls with, you know, reference that's going to be appropriate. And then over the weeks, then your brain gets in. It's like kind of the language, I guess, of what we're going to be doing.
Julian's work adds another element to the sets that allows everyone to become immersed in the Wizarding World. The same is true of set decorator Anna Pinnock, who adds more than a touch of magic to the sets once they've been painted. Let's head to Place Cachet to meet Anna.
This whole street here was all part of the Diamond District, part of Tribeca. So hence, with a bit of modification, but we have inherited some very large-scale windows, which they did have in Paris, but obviously that's been quite challenging because we've had these enormous windows, which in night shoots you have all the lights on, so of course that reveals a lot more inside the shops. So we've had to go right into a lot of these shops and dress them in great detail.
And just like Diagon Alley, Place Cachet is where French wizards and witches can pick up everything they could possibly need.
In Diagon Alley, of course, you've got the witch's cauldron shop, wizard cauldron shop, and we decided to do a French version with all the copper, which I think is fun, jelly molds and so on. And then we had to do a sweet shop because I just felt there was one in Diagon Alley and it would be rude not to. The apothecary, the essential apothecary, of course. Wizard apparel, Quidditch, and then the wand shop. Stuart particularly felt it was important to pay homage to Diagon Alley, to have that connection with the wizard world of Potter. So, I mean, that was fun. It's a complete fantasy world, actually, but what is so nice on this is to have the 1920s as a backdrop to depart from. So it's very important for us to do all the research so that we can knowingly depart from period accuracy. And especially in things, you know, like colour, we have tried to adhere to period colour. I think Colleen's done a lot of that in her work as well, but then with a nice twist. So it is good to not be slavish to period, too.
Working hand-in-hand with Anna Pinnock and Stuart Craig is prop modeler Pierre Bohanna. I know that name.
And if you can imagine even taking a basic house, you know, if you're like a kitchen, you'd have all the plates, all the saucepans, all the glassware and everything, and the pictures on the wall and the dustbins and all the rubbish, every little element that personalises that scene, they're responsible for. Obviously, on a film like The Potters or Fantastic Beasts, there's an element that you can't find, that you can't hire, that you can't buy, that has to be made. And that's really where we come in. We contribute to the making of the world. The interesting thing about working to a period is that there's almost a set of rules, a set of stylistic rules, a set of rules about how things were manufactured in the time period, that, you know, there was a lot less plastics and a lot less engineered furniture and a lot more older processes were used in there. So that had an influence in a way, a lot more done artisan way, a sort of different range of talents. The lovely thing about it is that every piece we make is a discovery. We never want to be doing the same thing twice. People don't go to cinema to see the same thing over and over. So every prop we make is kind of like a voyage of discovery. There's an archive in the Ministry of Magique, and we had to produce 1,200 of these boxes. And it only makes a section of it, making many, many of the same things, often the way it swings. They're all individually numbered. Katie, the art director, did a whole plan of numbered sequences so that everyone knew when they moved the camera around, they knew where it was. It was logistical. It makes my head hurt even thinking about it.
As well as kitting out the French ministry, the voyage of props discovery has taken Pierre and his team back to the Ministry of Magic in London.
There's a hearing room that Newt goes into, and beside the desk is this dictaphone, which was chugging away, and on the floor is a great ream of paper, and there's a quill that is constantly taking notes, dancing, obviously post-production per se. But then also out in the corridor, on Fantastic Beasts, for visual effects, we were asked to do representative puppets and to work with a group of wonderfully talented puppeteers who operated these puppets. And it was such a success that we came up with the idea that, well, it might be nice to make some props that they could puppeteer, that we could sort of populate and just put something with a bit of character. So one of these is this Hoover that we made for the Ministry of Magic. So this is chugging away in a corridor, sweeping away as it goes along. The guys are puppeteering it. And it has telescopic arms, it's dusting the walls, it's dusting, if you're close to it, it will dust you, and it's making a wonderful little fuss, and in a lovely magical way, is behind it is the bag, it's gently inflating, making more dust and more mess than it's ever picking up. So it's this kind of perpetual motion of hoovers as it's chugging along. So, yeah, we had great fun doing that. There you go. A small selection of many of the mad things that we've been able to make.
So now we've dressed the sets, we better get the actors dressed. Paris is often thought of as the most stylish capital city on the planet. But back in the 1920s, it wasn't just the height of fashion. It was fashion. And that sense of je ne sais quoi is what costume designer Colleen Atwood and hair and makeup designer Faye Hammond do best. Let's leave the back lot behind and head inside once again to the costume department. In Colleen Atwood's hands, every character's costume is designed to help tell his or her story, not least those worn by the four main characters. So let's hear from Colleen herself about the inspiration behind them, beginning with the most handsome.
Jacob, the fashion plate of the group, has, you know, the thought was he's accumulated some more, a successful bakery, has his bake shop in New York, and his suit fits a lot better now. It's a new suit. All the pieces are from the same fabric. I did his shoes out of the same fabric to match because I thought he was a guy that would always have a little flair, a character flair with whatever he has.
My God, she's right. Flair and spades, baby. Flair and spades. Sharon McCormick is one of the cutters working under Colleen Atwood.
I trained as a bespoke tailor, so I trained to do suits, basically, and then wangled my way into theatre and then into film. So I've been doing it for an awful long time now. Every film's unique, basically. Each story is wonderful. I think this is great because although I've worked on five of the Harry Potter series, this is a very different approach to how we're doing the costumes and how it's done. I draft the patterns, so I'll go into the fittings, we'll do fittings on the actors, and I have a team of people who stitch the costumes for me, basically.
I hope you're keeping count of the number of people who have worked on Harry Potter films, because I lost track.
This is one of Jacob's jackets. This is one of the many suits. He has one look, but it's repeated many, many times. So I think this is number 8. I'm cutting now. The fabric is a very fine, very beautiful English wool, but it is a very fine blue and black check. And it's very hard to see after a while which is the blue lines and which are the black lines. But you can from a distance, so we have to make sure this one looks exactly like his first one that we made him, basically. And the same as the ones that we've made for the stuntman or for the double and everybody else that wears this suit at some stage. In this case, we made 5 for Dan himself, and then we've made 2 for his stuntman and 1 for his double. It's a lot of blue plaid.
Queenie, played by Alison Sudal, is another character who ends up in Paris.
The minute that I put on my costume as Queenie, I do feel something. There's a real love and delight for beauty that Queenie has, and when I put on this dress, I kind of feel like Queenie. Colleen is an incredibly detailed and skillful craftsman as well as an amazing visionary, and so her clothing has this extraordinary precision and attention to the smallest details. Like, I have a little moth.
Queenie's still incredibly feminine. She had an idea that she'd like to be in plaid, so I found an old piece of 30s plaid fabric that had the right kind of feeling for the period and sort of riffed off that and created a textile that was similar to that but scaled it in a different way and made her dress. Well, I have a textile artist that works for me who's amazing, named Steve Gall, and he knows how to burn a silkscreen in an industrial way. We take the graphic, we put it on a computer, we dial it up, we dial it down, we do 3 or 4 samples of different scales, And then we get into the color work on it, because when you do a plaid, the color, the balance of the color is very tricky. Where something might look good in a room, when you get it on camera, one line in the plaid could stick out too much. So we sort of adjusted it a couple times.
I'm Steve Gell. I do the textiles. So we do the dyeing and the printing and the painting for the costume department. With Queenie's dress, her first thing was she gave me a piece of fabric that she liked the costume to be made out of. So we took the print, we looked at it, we dissected it, we turned it into a print that we could create and do a run of. So we did a run enough to make one dress, but by the time the dress was made, the first dress, the first prototype, then Colleen looked at it and said, okay, so this is working, but there's something about it which isn't working. The scale needs to be reduced for the size of the person. And also, how about we do it in reflection as well, so that you get the pattern running off from the central point, running both ways. So that meant going back to the drawing board, scaling it down, making screens for one side and then screens for the other side. And then by the time we put it together, it was working. And then it came to the bow, and so the bow was a certain colour, but by the time it was made, it looked too big and we had to reduce the scale of it. So it's all about composition, which depends on what the actor is like, the size of the actor, or even just the features on their face. It makes a difference to what that costume is going to end up looking like and what looks best on them.
I like the idea that it is Queenie. It feels like her, that's feminine and fluttery. It's got a little bit of darkness to it. It's a little more grown up than her last thing and a little less silly. But at the same time, it's got the whimsy of the big bow in the front and, you know, that she's been liking it. So that's important to me also.
Queenie's got some pretty cool accessories to go with that dress. Here's Allison again.
I felt like she should be wearing more jewelry this time, just a little bit more sophisticated, I guess. And Colleen had this pin of a moth, and the shape of the dress we kind of played around with. There's like a sort of collar type thing, and played around with it until it looked like a butterfly. And there's this transformation that's going where she's in a butterfly sort of transformation, but it's also the moth and butterfly of the night, you know, all kinds of fun things that we played with.
Queenie's sister Tina has a slightly different costume this time around.
Tina has more self-assurance here. Her costume's changed a lot. She's, you know, an active character. She has a leather coat that I made out of blue leather that's a really great silhouette on her, and it gives her kind of a powerful, mysterious shape. It's both feminine and masculine, which I like.
Tina is played by Catherine Waterston.
Colleen and I discussed whether or not I should wear the standard issue R coat in this film, but decided against it because Tina isn't confident that the ministry would approve of her desire to protect and save Credence. They are seeking him for a different reason, and so she's kind of doing this investigation on the sly. And so we wanted something that seemed as strong and powerful as a traditional aura coat, but had a slightly different feel to it and a different look. Man, this thing weighs so much. It's a workout just to put it on every day. It's really a heavy, big leather coat, but costumes are so important to me, and, you know, the shoes change the way you walk, feel, move, as does this coat, and it sort of functions like another scene partner. It really helps me define her and feel her. Yeah, so I tolerate the weight.
With Catherine, we had a moment, like trousers or skirts kind of thing, and then when the coat happened, she ended up back in trousers.
Colleen did try to get me into a dress, but I felt pretty strongly that just because Tina has grown more confident doesn't mean that she's become a different person, and I didn't want to communicate as some kind of misleading idea that just because she has some tomboy qualities that they are in any way linked to insecurity. That's just the way she likes to dress, and it works for her. So I'm still in my high waters.
It's not just Tina's costume that's changed. She also has a brand new haircut. Don't tell her I told you.
It's so neurotic and weird and nerdy, you know, all the things that go into the decisions we make for how to express character. But in the first film, I had imagined that she had some kind of long braid her whole life. And then, you know, the fashion changed and maybe Queenie was bugging her to get with the program. And so she took a big pair of, you know, kitchen scissors and just snipped the braid off. That's why it was sort of unattractive and blunt and simple. And, you know, she didn't quite know how to style it to the time or anything, you know. So that was sort of what I was after in the first one. I was thinking a lot about the romance with Newt and how that part of her life was awakened by him. She hadn't ever had any time for romance and didn't really relate to herself as someone who could have a romantic partner. So a kind of new awareness has come to her, a kind of maturity, I suppose, that she didn't have before. And an awareness maybe of herself as something that could be attractive to someone else. So I just thought that the idea that she would maybe for the first time in her life actually go into a hairdresser's seemed like a good thing for this film, that she's taking some kind of pleasure in herself in a way that she never had before.
Faye Hammond is the movie's hair and makeup designer.
We've only moved on another year as far as the first film was concerned, but we have got a lot of artistic license now. It's extremes. What we're doing, we're just pushing the style. As Colleen does with her costumes, obviously it's very important, the balance, but I love that sort of just having a hint of period. Strong finger waves are great. And what we've done also, we keep all the hair colours very strong and flat. So, you know, we have like black, and then the blondes, the red. The colour spectrum is lovely because we're looking at colours from the period, you know, and it was the flat colours. Hair dye was invented not long before this date, and everyone was experimenting. And we've taken it that bit further. We're taking elements and adding other elements and just seeing how brave we can go without being distracting. I think that's the important thing. And when David and I discuss together a character, you know, I do all the mood boards, I see what Colleen is planning for them. And then we sort of come down to about three looks, and then between David and I, I kind of know him enough now to know how far I can push things. Sometimes he'll say, no, I think we can go a bit more, or, oh, Faye, let's hold back up. You know, there is a fine line, and that's what's been enjoyable. It's a discipline to find that fine line. There's a sort of pull back to sort of feel that period element. It could be just the sort of short haircut on a man, but the front is much longer, you know, sort of, and maybe it's slightly asymmetric. It's just those little interesting bits and pieces that you can pull out. And it's great, but also it's remarkable when you do spend hours looking at proper 1920s/30s research. There's some extraordinary images. People really were very brave. You know, even if you just think even like a sort of typical Germanic haircut at the time, men had never had their hair cut that short. Women had never been so brave. They'd had long hair for hundreds of years. So this is a really exciting time. You know, hair, women were wearing men's haircuts, you know. All the girls are wearing wigs. Even Catherine has chosen that this time to feel that, right, end of the day, wig off, could be normal. So it does help. But the wig is actually great because you can actually dress with a great discipline. You can spend time before it goes on the actor's head, so it's already prepared, and it's much easier than trying to dress the actress's hair. And also that sort of simple, simplistic, gorgeous bob. You can't beat a simple bob. And we ummed and ahed about the fringe, but David decided he really liked it, and so did she. And so that's the big difference. By taking it a bit shorter, it's cut before it was kind of like maybe Queenie had cut it before. Now, you know, she's been to a new salon, it's looking a little more chic. You know, with that leather coat she wears, it's again a fantastic silhouette. And simple and clean, which are the lines very much of Tina. And the thing with Queenie too, she's on a journey because, again, she's not in her comfort zone so much anymore. Again, we see her soaked in the rain, literally her sort of third scene in the movie. So then we carry on throughout the movie with her sort of a bit bedraggled. She isn't all those glossy curls anymore. You know, she's searching. She's on the run, and you don't feel that glamour is... She's still naturally very pretty and everything, but that sort of polished, sort of bubbly look is certainly gone, and we all see at the end of the film there's a bit of a change.
Faye's team of makeup artists spend more than 12 hours a day on set. When they are working with the main member of the cast, they might begin work in their trailers as early as 6 a.m. They spend, on average, 40 minutes making us actors look our best.
And makeup-wise, we keep quite a simple palette. We have a lipstick, which actually I'm wearing now, Chanel lipstick, which we put on most people. Because, again, the palette of the film feels more comfortable. Rather than having too many colours, it's quite nice to contain your colours and keep it all... In fact, I think our department is the one department where we have to keep the sort of rather simpler, because there's so much else going on, and if you had it all going on, I think it'd be distracting.
Faye's right. There is so much else going on and much more for us to explore, and what better way to head off than with the help of the Action Vehicles Department. Action Vehicle! Action Vehicle! Action Vehicle Department! Which is probably, like, the coolest sounding department on the movie? Probably the coolest sounding department on the movie, I think. I want to be part of that department. What department are you working in, man? The Action Vehicle Department! Out of my way! Alex Barrett is the Assistant Action Vehicles Coordinator who works under another Alex, Alex King. He and the team are responsible for all the vehicles and forms of transportation that you see on the screen, from buses to bicycles and everything in between. And the shift from New York to Paris meant that they had to adapt a little too.
The difference between this film and the last one we did for Fantastic Beasts is that we're now in Paris and London as opposed to New York. So I suppose the main differences that we have between that one and this one is that last time, I suppose, they were big New York populated, busy streets. And on this one, it's a kind of smaller scale French look. So we have obviously purchased some French vehicles and added some French stock to our stock of vehicles.
But where do you buy 1920s vehicles? eBay?
The French ones that we've purchased, we have bought from various places across Europe, as well as finding, I think, the few that were available in the UK, which have mainly been Renaults and Citroëns. The Renaults particularly have a more distinct look to them, so they bring that much more French look to our vehicles, really. Most of the French ones that we've bought are mainly, well, they're 1920s basically. We're obviously set in 1928, so anything pre-1928 would have been suitable. We've had a Renault pickup, various Renault saloons, a couple of Tourers, and some Citroëns. Again, yeah, all 1920s from about, I think the earliest one we bought is 1921, I think, and then up to about 28.
But as is often the case with the Wizarding World, things aren't exactly what they seem.
Obviously, one of the problems we faced on the first film is the noise that you get from these vehicles and the amount of exhaust fumes that you get. So something we wanted to try on this was to remove the element of the noise and the exhaust fumes. Obviously, with those exhaust fumes, you can't bring those vehicles onto a stage without gassing people out. So we have converted six of our period vehicles into electric vehicles.
John Plummer is a trained mechanic and the Action Vehicles Workshop supervisor, and turning the cars electric is not as easy as you might think.
So the process of the electrics, the idea was given to us several months ago, can we have electric cars? And our first thought was electric golf buggies. They're available, they're cheap and easy to take apart. So we built one from that, working on the theory we're not going to be a great deal heavier. And they've kind of escalated from there. We built one and it was a success. We've now got just finishing our sixth one off. So the process is take a standard golf buggy, take it apart, build a subframe for the car to house the original golf buggy back axle, increase the strength of the back axles for the bearings, for the extra load, put new batteries into it, rewire the whole vehicle, and suddenly you've got almost an electric Model T or a Citroën or whatever you need. But they've been really quite successful. They've got a good range on them for a day shooting. They last quite nicely, and so far they've been quite a success.
Golf buggy. Here we go again with the buggy. Buggy, 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 buggy. Man, that still doesn't sound right. But who knew that they could be so versatile? Although there's another practical reason for this modification, as Alex Barrett explains. Man, I want a golf buggy.
It's really, really useful for dialogue scenes because, well, we can have them silently moving in the backgrounds and we can still populate those streets with vehicles without giving sound a nightmare, in theory. And, of course, we can now use them on the stage, which we were previously not able to do very easily. So they've been great, actually. I think they were a valuable asset to this film so far.
But don't be fooled, these cars require drivers with a particular set of skills.
Our drivers are kind of a mix between people that drive action vehicles sort of day in, day out on films, and we have some people that we found through sort of, you know, vintage car clubs and, you know, enthusiasts. So we went to people that, you know, provide us with some of our Model T parts and various other places where we purchased vintage vehicles. We found sort of owners clubs and people that are enthusiastic about the vehicles and have the knowledge behind driving them. So actually having a lot of those guys around with their knowledge and previous experience driving vintage cars is actually very nice to have around, and they're good chaps to have in and be involved in the project.
Didn't I tell you this department was the coolest? So John, what skills does one need to get a job with action vehicles? I'm asking for a friend, obviously.
You need to be a skilled mechanic that's not just a fitter. It's one of the things we always say. You need to know mechanics, not fitting. And that's where it all stems from. Everything is one-off builds. Even into modern stuff, everything's stuff you won't come across every day. So it's all a bit specialised. It really does take a special person, and then you've got the random hours that get thrown at you. So it keeps you on your toes.
Okay, I got it. Building a version of Paris on a studio lot was a giant feat of construction, craft, and imagination. The result is a series of sets which look authentic and magical at the same time. We gave you just a glimpse of what it takes to make this world come to life. But each step is vital, from research to concept art, sketches to blueprints, models to steelwork and sculpting, paintwork to props, and finally, vintage vehicles. And now we got our transportation sorted. It's time we head off to a topic that's even more difficult to navigate than the back streets of Paris. Relationships. Chapter 6, Relationships.
I think the friendship and the companionship and the bond between the four is so powerful, which is why when they're fragmented, it's problematic.
So a lot of the characters have their own arcs that will weave into each other eventually.
These people that were kind of desperate to come into their own but hadn't quite fully gotten there yet. I found that very compelling.
I love how it's a bunch of people that don't really fit into this magical world.
There's something interesting about working on a J.K. Rowling film is that the films, they reach so far that the world, as far as we're concerned, it's like we never leave them. The character sort of sits burning inside you a little bit. A sort of ember of Newt is sitting there. And what I love, and it's totally unique for me to firstly come back to playing a character that I've played before, but also with the same band.
That's right, the band's back together. And I'm ready to unleash my guitar solo. Watch out! Beady boop boo! But seriously, relationships are key to the wizarding world. Whether it's Harry, Ron and Hermione, Newt and Jacob, or the people behind the camera, including producer David Heyman, who reflects on the chance encounter that brought a boy named Harry Potter into his life.
In 1997, I was lucky enough to read an unpublished manuscript. How it came about was Tani Sagachin, who was head of development in my office, read an article in a trade publication, a book trade publication, about a book that was going to be published in, gosh, 6-8 months' time, I can't remember how long. And she got the book in, and it sat on the bottom shelf. We have three shelves in my office, priority, medium priority, and low priority, and it sat on that bottom shelf. And every weekend, we take home things to read. And Nisha, who was my assistant, generally took things from the bottom shelf, the low priority shelf. So she took home this book on Friday night, this unpublished manuscript. And on Monday, we have our staff meeting, which was basically the three of us, Nisha, Tanya, and me. And I asked, had anybody read anything good? And Nisha said, yes. It was called Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, which is the English title. And I said, that's a terrible title. What's it about? And she said, it's about a young boy who goes to wizard school. And my, you know, my ears perked up, and I thought that sounded interesting. And I took it home that night, and I read it in one sitting till around 2 or 3 in the morning. Shut the book, went to sleep, and, you know, began pursuing it the following morning. Sent it to Warner Brothers, to a man called Lionel Wigram. Lionel's also a producer now, but he and I had known each other since we were around 14 years old. And yeah, there began the odyssey. And really that was the reason why I pursued it. I had no idea. I thought it might make a nice, modest-sized British film. I could never imagine that 21 years later we'd be talking about 8 films and I'd be embarking upon the Fantastic Beasts adventure, the continuation or going back in time in the wonderful world that she's created. When we were making the Harry Potter films, we had the books, and Jo wasn't actively involved in the development of the films. She was there if we needed her. She was an incredible support and a great resource, but she wasn't developing them as she went. With this, she's the screenwriter. And so while a lot of the architecture and the characters is defined, and she has it very much in her head, and she knows where she's going, there's still a lot that is invented. And, you know, to be at the coalface of that is remarkable. She's not always bound by the traditional rules that screenwriters follow. You know, there's a 3-act structure, this happens here. Of course, it's not that rigid, but there is a structure. She doesn't live by those rules, and that's incredibly liberating. And I think it allows for an unexpected cocktail and an unexpected development, an unexpected story and unexpected storytelling, which I think is very fresh and really enjoyable.
Someone who enjoyed this fresh approach is our main man, Eddie Redmayne.
Well, I think what's unique for us in these films is that many of these characters aren't in books, and they're purely born out of Jo's imagination. And for us, that comes with responsibility, because you know that is one of the most unique imaginations in the world, and you want to flesh out those characters and show her all the colours that she has thought of. But what is amazing about J.K. Rowling is that she has a very, very detailed and intricate knowledge of who her characters are. And they are so there on the page, and yet within that she not only allows you, but encourages a freedom to explore, to delve really under the skin of who these people are and push the characters. And that's wonderful. And so what I think is amazing is that what I see on the Fantastic Beasts films are, we start with these nuggets that Jo delivers to us, and then through a collective combination of people's imaginations, every single department is being encouraged to fulfill their imaginations to 1,000%, and it's the collective of that that makes it so unique.
One of the most important relationships on any film set is that between the director and the cast.
You know, bringing the band back, you come back with a shorthand, with a knowledge of the way each other works, but with an absolute appetite to push and shift and change and not just fit back into a way of working. Of course, we all take our lead from the guy who's at the helm, which is David Yates. And what I love about what he's done with this film is he's reacted to how Jo has shifted the whole infrastructure of the thing and pushed this story into such a different place. And he has said, right, well, I'm going to approach it in a different way. This film is more rock and roll in the way that David's approached it. It's less pre-organized, pre-ordained. He's thinking on his feet. He's creating moments of chaos for us to solve problems and have freedom to push characters in different ways. I mean, David Yates is one of the most sort of kind-hearted people. There's a bit of anarchy going on, which has kept us all on our toes in a wonderful way and made sure that we never feel settled and safe, but that these characters are being pushed.
For Jude Law and Claudia Kim, Fantastic Beasts: The Crimes of Grindelwald marks their first step into the Wizarding world and their first time working with David Yates.
David has a really efficient but comprehensive approach, I think, to this kind of filmmaking. He gives the actors so much time to discover what they need to discover to make a scene their own and to feel natural and real. When you're filming it, we were given detailed discussions and the analysis and picking little things apart and trying to highlight moments that we know are important that we want to get, you know, closing in and really ensuring those are given their due.
Claudia Kim.
I think David, first of all, he takes time to listen to the actors. He incorporates our thoughts into the scenes, so we're able to play with it. He allows us to do several takes, just all differently, and just kind of figure it out along the way. He's someone that understands actors so well. His direction is incredibly accurate. Sometimes it's like he's reading your mind. But you don't feel exposed because he creates this safe environment. The way he delivers this is so kind. One of the things that he always says is, you gotta feel it in your tummy. And, you know, he puts it in such a kind way. And one of his strengths is that he doesn't get lost, because we have these massive scenes with so many different characters and so many different emotions going on, and he doesn't get lost in the size of it, in the scale of it all, and he pays so much attention to the emotional details and the emotional journeys that these characters go through.
And what well-rounded and fully fleshed-out characters they all are. And for that, we have to thank J.K. Rowling. Eddie again.
J.K. Rowling writes about outcasts, often people who don't feel comfortable necessarily in their skin, and often the way that they develop as characters is through finding people who are on the edges and the peripheries. And what I loved in the first film was that Jo had created four such unique characters, all who in their own ways were struggling or fighting their own battles. And it is through the relationships with each other, through that kind of symbiosis, that they further themselves and they find happiness, love, contentment. They don't necessarily find it, but they find the beginning of the path towards it.
Two of our characters who certainly haven't found it yet are Newt and Tina. Catherine Waterston again.
I think he did a little bit more of the rescuing in the last one because I'd been demoted at work and couldn't practice magic as powerfully as I am now, so it's maybe a little more balanced now. I think it's just one of those things that these two people, that they obviously have similarities. They're both a little awkward and shy in some ways, but really thrive in high-stakes, sort of dangerous situations and feel comfortable in those situations. Some people go kind of foggy in a crisis, and these two people, they get clearer. So there's a lot of wonderful moments where we have to act very quickly and efficiently, and it's fun to try to seem like I am someone more coordinated than I actually am.
Miscommunication and misunderstanding seems to be the rule of thumb with these two lovebirds, who are probably more alike than they care to admit. For now, though, this relationship involves a lot of chasing.
He chases me. We get chased by other people. We hide a lot. Creatures chase us. So there's a lot of running. Eddie is a very explosive sprinter, so I always pull like every muscle in my body when I run with him because he can go from standing still to very fast, and I kind of have to rev up. We help each other out a lot in this one.
Another couple for which running is a recurring theme is Ezra Miller's Credence and Claudia Kim's Nagini, who we left in Chapter 4 fleeing Circus Arcanus. Their relationship is, well, it's complicated. Given that one is an obscurial and the other is afflicted with a blood curse that will eventually see her transform into a beast. And you thought you had problems. Jeez, talk about baggage. I'm not getting involved. I'll leave this one up to Ezra and Claudia.
I think that relationship is a really special and interesting one. It's complicated. There's real love there coming from two people who are both struggling in similar ways as being unusual or different, as carrying these otherworldly aspects of themselves that remove them from society. And they're sort of thrust into this situation wherein they're very codependent. And within that, they're trying to, I think, both figure themselves out